offering our loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, joining you is Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai. The last week and the week before that, we had the Bhagwat Vaini Satsang. Now it's time to go back to that fascinating journey we started a couple of weeks back. The journey to Africa. In fact, East Africa, the only place where Swami visited outside of India. And more than just a journey, this was another sojourn of Swami in fulfilling the seeking of many, many devotees who were yearning to have His presence, who probably did not have the wherewithal to come all the way to Vrindavan and Whitefield or to Puttaparthi to have Swami's darshan. But Swami went out into not just the people there, but even to the wild. And in fact, that's the part we're going to be talking today. And before I tell much more than needed, let me invite Arvind to join all of us. Fasten your seatbelts, because this is going to be a very, very beautiful journey into the wild of the Africa. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem. And as you rightly said, we should fasten our seatbelts, because it was around this time, that is early in the morning at around 7 a.m. on the 3rd of July 1968, when Bhagwan was also fastening his seatbelts for an actual takeoff. As we had discussed earlier, Dr. Chotabhai G. Patel was Bhagwan's host at Kampala, that is Uganda. And Swami had traveled to Kampala from Nairobi, where he had landed in Kenya. So across country, we saw the kind of reception that Bhagwan received everywhere, how the day, entire day Swami spent in showering His love on the devotees. And now came the time to bless the other devotees, the animals, because all said and done, they too are souls who are in this journey of life, traveling towards the ultimate. And that is from a spiritual perspective. From a physical perspective, it's very obvious that the host, C.G. Patel, Dr. C.G. Patel, would have felt that I'm getting the divine as my guest. It is my bounden duty to show him the wonders of our place. So he had requested Swami to, you know, even when Swami was at Kampala, to visit the Baha'i temple and the other Sarvadharma temple, which we spoke about. Though Swami said he was not very keen, I think Swami did his dharma, his duty as a guest. As a guest, just as a host, you treat your guest as God. And in this case, Atithi Devo Bhava couldn't have come more true than this, because God Himself was the guest.
Right.
But I think as a guest, it is your duty also to give respect and regard to the host's wishes and desires. That's what Swami was doing. That's the reason He had gone around in the city of Kampala as well. And now, it was the desire of Dr. C.G. Patel to take Swami to what is today considered as the as a heritage site with one of the largest densities of wildlife in the entire globe. And that is the Gorongoro Crater. The Gorongoro Crater, as the name suggests, is actually the crater of a huge ancient volcano, mm-hmm. which has gone dead now. We know that we have active volcanoes which keep firing every now and then. We have dormant volcanoes which have the potential to fire up but have not fired in the recent past for a long time. And then there are the dead volcanoes, which there is no chance of them firing. So the Gorongoro Crater is actually the crater of a huge volcano. And when I say huge, let me just give a rough idea. The area inside the volcano is about 350 square kilometers. 350 square kilometers is the crater of the volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it is the richest density of wildlife can be understood from the fact that when a volcano erupts, the lava comes out. It is all the substance that is buried in the heart of the globe, in the heart of the earth. And all these are very, very rich in minerals and nutrients. And therefore, they give rise to a mind-boggling array of flora. Lot of plants grow, and such variety of plants naturally support an equal amazing variety of animal life. And because it is so rich, therefore the biodiversity also becomes very rich in this place. And this is the place that Dr. C.G. Patel wanted to take Swami to. This Gorongoro crater is located in Tanzania. Now, as we had said 2 weeks back, there is this Lake Victoria which is bound on three sides by three different countries. One is Kenya, one is Uganda. Actually, it's Uganda towards the north and northwest. It is Kenya towards the northeast. Mm-hmm. And towards the southeast, it is Tanzania. So, the idea was to take off from Uganda, Kampala, fly across Lake Victoria, across the Serengeti, which is the grassland, again famous for its wildlife, and then land in the Gorongoro crater itself in Tanzania. So with this plan, they set out and Swami and the entourage reached the airport at Entebbe by 7 o'clock in the morning because their flight was scheduled to take off around 7:15,
7:30. Right, and as Professor Kasturi writes, they took off on two different flights after that. But, you know, come to think of it, many times you wonder, you know, this whole arrangement was being made. Swami was being invited to Africa, all with the idea that here is, you know, divinity in the human form and we need to get as much grace from him as possible. But after having done that, you completely forget that here is the one who's created this entire diversity and you want to show him the biodiversity and take him around. I mean, it's definitely a very beautiful interaction between the Lord and his devotees. There's no doubt about that. But how many times do we completely forget that? For instance, this morning we were listening to about the incident where Swami, you know, took on the paralysis of a devotee during the 1963 Guru Purnima. Mm-hmm. Where I think even in the course of this narration, Professor Kasturi makes a reference to that. Because he says we're still, that image is still fresh in their mind. This is 6 years later around the Guru Purnima time. But during that event, you know, they all saw in front of their eyes that Swami was carried down from his room. And in front of all of them, Swami cured himself completely from speaking in an intelligible tone to not being able to walk, dragging his feet. From that, Swami got up and started speaking. And there was one devotee who was there, who was doing volunteer duty. He was narrating how when that miracle happened, all of them were ecstatic. They were jumping in joy and all that. But during the course of that discourse, Swami sang Subramanyam Subramanyam Bhajan. And he sang it twice as fast as he would usually sing. And even as Swami was singing that, he said the doctor in him was panicking because he was saying, Swami, just now you've become all right. Don't give such a difficult task to your tongue, you know, which was slurring just a moment ago. And he had to literally slap himself and say, what am I doing? Just now you witnessed a miracle which none of your medical science can prove or, you know, explain. And now you're back to treating Swami like a patient. You know, I think that's probably the beauty of the relationship which we all enjoy with Swami. Because on one hand, all of our interaction with him and love and reverence is all based on the idea that here is the creator of all of us. But just tagging along is this idea that, you know, what does Swami like? How can we entertain Swami? What can we do to Swami, to make Swami smile, right?
Many times I keep saying this, that this term Maya or illusion or delusion, where we, I'm speaking only of that aspect where we forget Swami's identity. That is why we want to go behind his likes, his dislikes, what he would like to, how he would like to travel, and treat him like our friend, our mother or father or anybody like that. That, in that case, Maya becomes such a beautiful blessing, isn't it? Because it is Maya that allows us to relate to him as a guru. It is Maya that allows us to relate to him as a friend, as a father, as a mother, or whatever, you know, whatever relationship we would like. Because without Maya, it's only the truth that there's no difference between him and me. Possibly God himself doesn't like it because Swami says, in the beginning there was nothing, only I existed. And I separated myself from myself so that I can love myself. And it is Maya that the Lord used to separate himself from himself. And therefore I think rather than simply curse Maya as something that is bad and something that has to be overcome, we can look at all these advantages that Maya gives us. Maya allows us to create these memories. Maya allows us to enjoy something that you cannot enjoy in Advaita. Possibly, if I can put it that way. I don't know the joy of Advaita, for I have rarely experienced it or maybe never experienced it. But definitely, the joys of Dvaita in those moments, whenever we have had to spend with Swami, oh my God, they are so beautiful. And that was the joy that Swami was bestowing on his guest, on his hosts. And Swami drove, of course, from Kampala to Entebbe Airport. As we said again earlier, this Entebbe Airport is located almost on the shore of this lake, of Lake Victoria, which is the birth cradle for the Nile, River Nile. So it's about a 40 kilometer distance, and they started early from C.G. Patel's home. This is amazing because, as we discussed, the previous night it was almost midnight before Swami actually retired. And now again, by 5, Swami is up, and by 6 they have started off, and by 7 they are at the airport. 7:15 they take off, and they had chartered 2 planes. For Bhagwan, there was a dual engine plane. And for Kasturi Garu and the others who were accompanying Swami, there was a single engine Super Sky wagon. This was the plane. And it's very nice because it's nice to read this now, because Professor Kasturi writes that he had a lot of trepidation before getting onto the plane. Because, you know, on the face of it, when you look at it, Swami's plane has got 2 engines. In case of any malfunction or something, you know, there is a second engine to bank upon. The probability of 2 engines failing at the same time is far less than the probability of 1 engine failing, which is 50%. And so when we actually read the articles or different descriptions that Professor Kasturi writes, many times, you know, he writes like as I said, they were going to fly across Lake Victoria. And Professor Kasturi writes, and we flew across this marvelous expanse, so in his own beautiful words he writes, on a single heart. You know, he's referring to the, he makes 2-3 references to this plane having only a single engine. Because, you know, this Lake Victoria that we are talking about, just, Prem, it's a misnomer to call it Lake Victoria, because it is 250 miles broad and 1,500 miles long. It's bigger than 3-4 countries put together. That is the vast expanse of fresh water that is there. And when you fly across it, as Professor Kasturi writes, sputtering across on a single heart, it is definitely going to cause you to skip a few heartbeats. That's what happened to Professor Kasturi. But I think, placing their faith in Swami, all of them got onto the aircraft, and these 2 aircrafts took off from Entebbe, flying across Lake Victoria.
reminds you of what some of these old devotees would say when Swami takes to the wheels, you know, when he used to drive the car when he was in his late teens and early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami himself used to speak about it. I remember Swami narrating it in Thrayi once.
Mm.
Swami used to drive the car so fast, and Swami would say that not even an ant will be killed in spite of that speed.
Mm.
Because Swami said, I was in total control, but you know, sometimes I would take along some devotee with me, maybe, you know, Seshagiri Rao or some of these elderly devotees. And Swami would say that they'll be sitting next to me and they'll be saying, Sai Ram, Sai Ram, Sai Ram, Sai Ram.
Sai Ram is only driving your car.
As Swami's driving, like, you know, Swami will be driving crazy speed, and they'll be sitting and saying, Sai Ram, Sai Ram, Sai Ram. And you know, I remember Swami narrating that incident. Typically,
I also remember, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, Swami also narrating that how he would leave the steering and it would steer on its own, no, and that would make them more tense, saying, Swami, please. You know,
I'm sure Swami must have done all that.
see, these kind of experiences that we listen to, is it not because of Maya? If not for Maya, when Swami, you know, when you lose control of the car, when you're driving, you call out to Sai Ram, you call out to Swami, because you know that Swami need not actually hold the steering or press the pedals to control the car that you're seated in. But when the physical form of the avatar is actually doing that beside you in the car, you get tense and you say, Swami, please don't sit cross-legged on the seat. Put your legs down onto the pedal. Please hold the steering wheel with both your hands. You're leaving it, you're not even holding it one hand. You know, all this thing comes in. But these are the beautiful memories and moments that get created.
Exactly. I think each one of these really has a spiritual message. Because even as Professor Kasturi was, you know, flying that plane and probably having all these trepidations in mind, I'm sure he must have learnt some deeper lessons in the process. You know, because you know that Swami is there, and, you know, your life or your security does not depend on whether the plane has a single engine or a dual engine. because you know where your faith has been placed, as like that beautiful analogy which Swami would give about a bird which sits on a, you know, branch during a stormy night. Even though the scare of that branch breaking all the time is always there, the bird always has its faith on its wings and not on, you know, the branch. And same is the case with, which I'm sure people like Professor Kasturi would have thought of. And, you know, that's why every trip which Swami makes is special in many, many levels. Of course, Swami was giving his divine discourses, as we'll come to that, Swami's many interactions and some of the things which were noted by the people who traveled with Swami. But apart from that, every small move, every small interaction with Swami created an opportunity for was a lesson to learn from. And, you know, I remember somebody narrating this about Swami's Kashmir trip, one of the students who were part of Swami's Kashmir trip. See, coming from South India and most of the time spending in Rayalaseema, you go to Kashmir and see those valleys, it's really breathtakingly beautiful. And this person was saying that for one moment when they were looking at some of those sceneries, it suddenly hit them that the one who created all this beauty was with them. Right? It's almost like standing next to the painter who's painted a masterpiece and you're reveling at the masterpiece. And imagine, that's what these people are seeing. They're flying across this Lake Victoria, which is looking so beautiful, across Serengeti, and Professor Kasturi writes how they see, I don't know what's the collective noun for that, of giraffes and zebras and herds of all these animals. And they finally land near the lake, near the, you know, in the banks of a lake, where they see this hundreds and hundreds of flamingos, which is a sight we have seen in our textbooks, you know, to see it live along with Swami next to you. I mean, it must have been really, really a different experience.
When you were speaking about the masterpiece, you know, my thoughts went along this direction. We travel to Kashmir and see those beautiful sights there and say, this is a masterpiece. We look at the magnificent animals there in Africa and say, this is the Lord's masterpiece. What we don't realize is what we think as the rocky plains of Rayalaseema, that is also the Lord's masterpiece. Mm. It's just that we have got familiar to it and we don't appreciate it. Because some of the top photographs that you see winning awards of the Sahara Desert, the sand dunes, they actually make me want to go and have a look at those dunes myself. But I don't think the people who are living in Saharan Africa ever see the beauty and grandeur of those dunes. For them, it is a daily battle that they have to wage to survive. It's like that. So I don't think they will be tuned to see the beauty and grandeur of the Lord's creation in the shifting sand dunes and the searing heat. Why I say this is because in preparation for this satsang, I went through many of these videos, you know, wherever Swami had been, Gorongoro Crater, the Nairobi National Park. I just went through those videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I noticed is the amount of fascination that the tourists are having, the locals seem to lack it, you know. If you are walking in Puttaparthi and you are a resident, you have been in Puttaparthi for 10 years, Prem, when you are walking, you see a donkey come across, you see a dog. You don't stand and see, wow, look at that magnificent creature, the Lord's creation. You don't do that. And if you see somebody doing it, maybe you'll also smile to yourself, you know. If you see somebody standing, focusing, taking close-up photos of the donkey or the dog or a pig that we see every day, you may be surprised and thinking that, oh, boy, this guy is crazy to photograph these. The locals there almost think like that, you know, because zebras, these wild beasts, these buffaloes, the way they walk, in some areas, it is such that on this side, there's like a market going on. There's like a fence, and on the other side, you can see some zebras and antelopes walking around, like how we see donkeys and dogs walking around here. I sincerely felt that maybe not many of them stand there and see that, wow, look at the Lord's masterpiece. So actually, everything is the Lord's masterpiece. Just like the grass is greener on the other side, when we go to a thing that we have not witnessed, we feel the more masterpiece effect of that, just like all those on Bhagwan's entourage felt, looking, as you said, you know, they saw all these animals because when you travel from Kampala to the Gorongoro, as soon as you cross Lake Victoria, that itself might have taken an hour and a half to cross Lake Victoria. Once you cross that, you directly enter into the Serengeti. The Serengeti grass, it's a grassland with a large wildlife population. And since it's a grassland, there are not many very tall trees or foliage that will block the ground.
Right.
So even though you are thousands of meters up in the sky, you can still look down and see the animals moving. And that was the magnificent sight that Professor Kasturi is narrating. It actually ignites that interest in you. Again, go to YouTube and check out some of those videos, aerial videos of the Serengeti. It's so magnificent. We can get an experience of the thrill that these people might have felt looking at the large herds of gazelle, antelope, zebra, some giraffes, some ostriches, all these that they see. And as you said, flamingos by the millions. And when Professor Kasturi writes flamingos by the millions, in no way is he exaggerating. Because they are literally present in a million. Imagine 1 million pink birds. Oh my God, it would be an ocean of pink. And that's exactly how even the videos show. And this is what they were seeing with the creator by their side, the creation outside the window. Actually, creator by their side is a figurative term because creator was in the flight ahead, which had two engines, which Kasturi always points out that, it's like a safer plane and we were in a one-hearted plane. But they finally crossed that and it's around 9:15 in the morning when they land in the crater. There's an airstrip in the Gorongoro crater. Naturally, as I said, it's a 350 square kilometer huge crater. So they land in the crater by the side of a lake. Again, that lake is teeming with a million flamingos and they are now awaiting a few other guests who would be arriving to the Gorongoro crater from Nairobi. We spoke about Bob Raymer and his interesting experience on the flight from Mumbai to Nairobi. So, Bob Raymer and a few others, they travel from Nairobi and they also land in the Gorongoro crater. And once these three planes have landed, they are ready for the further proceedings of the day.
Right, and of course, there's a beautiful description of the different kinds of wildlife that they chance to see upon, but Professor Kasturi writes that all of them were more keen to look at the king of the jungle more than anything else, because as you're saying, one thing is, probably these are different varieties of animals which we always get to see here, probably deers, there are always many deers around Swami, and yeah, you kind of get to see a different species of the same, variety there. But a lion is something which is always different,
Totally it's different.
And to see it in the wild, it's a completely different experience. And I'm sure most of them were wondering when they will chance upon that. And finally they say that, as you're saying, it's a grassland. And, the chance of finding such animals very close by is so very common. And finally, they see a lion. In fact, I think in one of Swami's discourses, Swami speaks about that incidence of these lions, so casually lying around, totally not afraid of the vehicles coming by or anything. In fact, Swami also says that one of the vehicles ran over the tail of one of those lions. Right?
Even Professor Kasturi records that. He says that we nearly ran over a few lionesses in our jeep because they were sitting so silently and Professor Kasturi, the way he writes, he says we were so tempted, they looked so domesticated, but they were reminded by the rangers there that they are used to vehicles. Mm-hmm. They are used to vehicles coming, but they are not used to people. Mm-hmm. So you can't get off the vehicle and go close to them because that is something that they are not used to. Mm-hmm. But vehicles, they have got used to seeing them all around, so that it doesn't matter to them, they are part of the landscape. That is the reason they appear domesticated, but they are as wild can be.
Right. So that is one of the things which they see. And I mean, as you said, the more guests join them and they go around in this thing. I think that whole morning is spent looking around at all of these things.
Professor Kasturi describes one interesting episode as well as some observations he makes. He says that after some time, he saw these lionesses getting ready, in a kind of a hunt mode.
Just when they were thinking that these are domesticated and,
they're lazying around and, they're getting ready for a hunt and, a kind of pack behavior is coming in. Some lionesses set out there and Professor Kasturi is saying that they're so eagerly watching this, but they were in for a disappointment because even before the attack could be launched, the deer that were being targeted, they just run away. And Professor Kasturi says that we just wanted to stay on for longer to have a look because this is something that I think Professor Kasturi is seeing for the first time maybe. Mm-hmm. Because in India you don't get to see lions like this. So when he says this, Swami begins to discourse on the kind of mutualism that exists, the mutual cooperation and coexistence that is there among the animals. So he, Swami points out that, you know, those giraffes, they're standing there like tall towers, they're the sentries, they have sent a message and alerted these other animals down that I can see a lion that's waiting to attack, and that is what gave them the lead signal to escape. And Professor Kasturi writes that Swami was more fascinated and interested in this mechanism of cooperation and harmony between animals rather than the coordinated attack that was happening. And you know, there you see the difference in focus. I put myself in Professor Kasturi's shoes and I felt this is what I also would be interested in Africa, you know. I won't be interested in seeing how the herbivores are coordinating between themselves to escape. I would like to see a lion attack and a lion chase being successful. But he says it was different with Swami. Swami was more interested in that peaceful aspect and it highlights such an important thing, because in the world there are both happening. In the world, just like you have lions attacking and the herbivores, the deer escaping, so too there is good and bad. You know, I'm just making a, it's not like a lion attacking is bad or something like that, but just like these two exist, in the world also there is good and bad. And what we see is what we focus on. And Swami, this is, I felt, a message that is coming through, because always when we see Swami, Swami always focuses on the good, good, good. Even in what, whom we consider as bad, even in them, Swami sees only the good. And that was on show in this African visit here, because again, as Professor Kasturi writes, Swami was totally involved in seeing the kind of harmony and cooperation that exists during a very bloody hunt that is going on there, you know? So that shows the divine's ability to see the good in everything, because if we have the ability to see the good in everything, the whole world will be good. As Swami says, there's only problem in the drishti, your vision, not in the srishti or creation.
So once apparently when Swami was talking, he made this statement. I don't know if it was part of a poem or what it was. Swami said, God helps the deer find the grass. God helps the lion find the deer. Right? I mean, it's a very profound thing. As you're saying, the lion being able to find its game or get its game is not the wrong part. But we definitely tend to focus on it not because it's natural. It's because it's, you know, it gives you the adrenaline rush more than anything else. In fact, there was an analysis on some of these channels which focus on wildlife and how they've changed over the years. And I think even you'll be able to relate to that, because when we were children, most of these channels, when they focus on wildlife, it used to be about the life in the, you know, as a pack or in the community there. It used to be a little slow, you know, they would build a story and, you know, they would say this is the head of the pack and this is the small one and all of that. And it seems a very drastic shift happened sometime probably in the 90s or even later than that, when they started making these channels a little more aggressive, because that's what started selling.
You know, and because now, of a drop in patience levels.
Right. And because people want to see that. People want to see, as you're saying, that aggression and, you know, that rush and the chase and, you know, the music which goes with that. I mean, probably it's a shift in our human approach to life itself. You know, we all are getting more aggressive in many ways. And that's what appeals to us. We want to see action. In fact, depending on which region you come from, I think the content varies accordingly. For instance, people would say the people, especially in countries like Australia, they always like to see the underdog triumph, right? So when they do programming for them, they would make, like, you know, the prey escapes or things like that. You know, you still have the chase part of it, but, you know, that aspect. So I think it's actually a sign of what we concentrate on, as you're saying. What we focus on is a sign of what is happening internally. And when Swami was showing that I'm more interested in this, it's not like this is natural and that is not. You know, that's not the approach. Swami is saying that, you know, as a human being which is trying to progress towards the divine state, focus on these aspects of nature, of where there is mutualism, where there is, you know, coordination between two species for living together. I think Swami was saying that focus on these aspects for your own growth. It's not that the other part is not natural or good for nature.
When Bhagwan says there's nothing wrong in Srishti, it's all in your drishti, that is, there's nothing wrong in creation, it's all in your vision. Of course, one message that comes out is, as you said, focus on the good. The other message that comes out is that our vision is not broad enough. For if I take, you know, that this lion is trying to kill a deer, it's bad, it's wrong, because it's killing another creature. You know, there are scientific studies that shows that these top level predators are so important, because if not for them, the herbivores overgraze, destroy the vegetation of the region, and it could lead to an imbalance in the ecosystem. Over years and possibly decades, it could lead to a complete destruction of that ecosystem itself. In fact, there are many recorded cases of how these kind of deserts and things have got created because of little imbalances. And therefore, balance is necessary. That is where the statement you made comes into play, where you say that God helps the deer find the grass, helps the lion find the deer. Our vision is so narrow that we always look from the perspective mostly of only our own self, because we are so selfish. Or if we are little broad-minded, we think from the perspective of ourselves, our family, and maybe our society. We are so narrow in our thinking. Because if we are able to actually broaden our thinking, the way we do things will be totally different. And though I know I'm stepping slightly out of the topic here, because I'm not stepping out of the topic, I'm stepping out of this African trip here. But because it is said that if we can broaden, we can benefit so much. Just yesterday, you know, I was reading about a courier service called UPL.
Mm-hmm.
No, UPL or UPS, I think. I think it's UPS.
UPS.
So, this courier service, you know what, they have their delivery trucks going out and delivering stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And all these delivery trucks are routed by a transportation programming in the computer, where you set in something saying, usually it is find the shortest route and find the most nominal way of delivering all these at these different addresses, assign them to these many trucks. They have thousands of trucks going around. They said they found an interesting thing. In a country where you drive on the left-hand side, like India, so when you have to take a right turn, you have to drive against the oncoming traffic. You know, you have to wait, mm-hmm. because everybody is driving on the left. But if you have to take a left turn, you don't have to. You can flow along with the traffic and you don't have to wait. So they gave in an additional logic to the system, saying, take only left turns if possible, you know, for a country where you do left-hand side driving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it will be opposite for the other thing.
Right.
So they did this, they said that overall, for some individual trucks, you know, the distance that they have to go has increased a lot. But they say that because it's always flowing with the flow, going with the flow, the computer now makes a programming in such a way that most of the time, less than 10% of the turns you have to take is right. You know, understand? 90% of the turn is left. Mm-hmm. I mean, 90% is along with the flow. So, though individual trucks may get affected, they have found that overall, the carbon footprint they have reduced is so huge. The cost reduction is huge. They have found this to be the single most important factor determining their increased profitability. And they say it makes sense to us only because we are such a huge organization. We have so many trucks that have to make so many deliveries. If the same thing has to be done on a small scale, it might not be that profitable. Now, why this is interesting is because the question in that end of that article that is asked is, why don't all courier companies just do this? Why courier companies, any delivery system, why don't they just program that all your vehicles move along with the flow? Overall, it will lead to huge savings in fuel, mm-hmm. in cost, everything, overall. But you know what the problem is? They say that if you have to feel the benefit of this move, you have to be minimum some certain size. So if you are below that size, you as a company or you as an individual, say me as an individual, if I have to travel from point A to point B, it makes sense for me to take only left turns.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm contributing to the global good. But you know what? Personally, I pay more for fuel. Personally, I suffer. And that is where my selfishness comes in. And that is why they say this can't be incorporated into the real world, because everyone simply won't agree. Because you have to be a certain size. That company has around 8,000 trucks, so it makes sense for them. I don't have 8,000 vehicles. If I have anything less than that, I'm going to suffer. And this is where the ability to see higher and sacrifice, you know, comes into play. If we are able to look at the large picture, then we will automatically not strive for individual excellence. That is what Professor G.V. would say, that we learn from nature. Nature gives up efficiency for the sake of sufficiency. He says, why doesn't a plant produce only 10 seeds and protect them in such a manner that no animal or bird will be able to touch it? No. Instead, the plant will produce 10,000 seeds, say 5,000 are taken by ants, 3,000 are taken by birds, finally only 10 seeds go, it's enough. Instead of investing in protecting the 10 seeds and making them absolutely impenetrable, it chooses to produce lot, and statistically even if 10 go, it's enough. That is because the tree is not looking at its own benefit. It's always having the larger picture in mind, and this is an important lesson we have to learn from nature. I'm sorry for this long digression, but I just felt it is necessary to state it here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as Swami would say so many times, there's no better teacher than nature. And, you know, many times what we have to learn to progress from the human state to the higher states can be learned from nature, because, you know, this is a conscious move which you make, as Swami would say, that from the human to the divine is a conscious move. But from the lower levels to the human state is actually a very, very spontaneous move. So when you look at it, you know what is a spontaneous mechanism, and you are trying to mimic it in your human state. And that's why the study of nature is always a very, very important thing. And as you said, it happens so silently and effortlessly and without much ado. And that's where the learning comes from. And even as we were going through, you know, our understanding of nature, Swami completes that journey in the crater, because it was by then sometime in the afternoon, around 4 o'clock, when the trip gets over. And Swami does not depart before he speaks to all the rangers who are showing Swami around. The narration goes that Swami materializes Vibhuti for those who knew the value of Vibhuti. I think those must have been the Indian rangers, if at all any. For the African, Swami gives a picture of himself. You know, I'm sure that would have been a beautiful memory for most of them. Swami gives a picture of himself, and then Professor Kasturi writes, the pilot of the plane which Swami was traveling in, he was a Christian, and for him, Swami materializes
a Britisher,
and Swami materializes a picture of Jesus Christ for him, right?
On an enamel pendant. And later, you know, he sees that he is looking at the people who have received Swami's photo and says, do you want my picture also? And then materializes one more photo of
Swami
himself.
Right, and gives. And then, as Professor Kasturi writes, Swami gets into his dual engine plane, and they get back into their single engine plane, and he emphasizes that, and then they fly out of the crater. And that's how the trip to the, you know, Gorongoro crater comes to an end. I think we'll take a break at this point. We'll continue our journey, because at the end of this, Swami is going to the city of Nairobi, right, where he spends the rest of the day.
Where he's scheduled to deliver a public address.
The first public address during the trip. But we'll come to that after this short break.
Sairanga Pandharisha, Sairanga Pandharisha, Jayaranga Panduranga, Jayaranga Panduranga, Jayaranga Panduranga, Jayaranga Panduranga, Jayaranga Pandharisha, Jayaranga Jairanga Pandharisha, Jairanga Pandharisha, Jai Shirdisha, Jai Paratisha, Jai Shirdisha, Jai Paratisha, Jai Shirdisha, Jai Paratisha, Jai Shirdisha, Jai Paratisha, పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ
శిరీషా పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ సాయి
పావన పురుష జయ
సాయి జయ గంగా పాండురంగా జయ హరి విఠల శ్రీ హరి విఠల
జయ హరి విఠల శ్రీ హరి
విఠల
జయ హరి విఠల
శ్రీ హరి విఠల హరి విఠల
జయ హరి విఠల
శ్రీ హరి విఠల
జయ హరి
విఠల శ్రీ హరి విఠల
జయ హరి విఠల
శ్రీ హరి విఠల హరి విఠల 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 విఠల
Welcome back, dear listeners. As you can hear the background music, that's precisely what we are talking about because it's the African safari. We just concluded one safari which Swami made and he's concluded that. He's gone back to, as we said, Nairobi. The Gorongoro crater is where Swami visited. They flew past the Serengeti. They ventured into the grasslands. They saw wildlife. They saw lions. In fact, literally drove over a few, as Professor Kasturi narrates and even as Swami had narrated later. Now they go back to Nairobi at around 4 p.m. Swami, and I think they reach there sometime around 6 p.m. must be, because around 6:30 was scheduled Swami's discourse that evening.
They take off around 4 p.m. and interesting thing is, see, they're in Gorongoro, which I said is the crater of a dead volcano. But as they fly via Lake Natron, Lake Natron is another huge lake that comes between Tanzania and Kenya. So they had to fly across Lake Natron. There, Professor Kasturi records that they saw a sight that they will not forget in the rest of their life. The actual fumes emanating from a volcano. There was a little active volcano, and seeing it, you know, it brought out the poet in Professor Kasturi, and he says this was the Lord of Fire offering incense to the Lord in the skies. It looked almost like that. Swami is in the sky and Mother Earth was offering her agarbatti to Swami because smoke was coming out of this volcano, and they saw that. Then this volcano was near Lake Natron. And then again, as they fly to Nairobi, there was some kind of a delay in their landing, because of which they didn't get immediately permission to land. So the pilot had to keep hovering around. So the only empty space there was the Nairobi National Park. The Nairobi National Park is in Nairobi, a national park within a city, just imagine that. And they were hovering over the Nairobi National Park. And as they were hovering, again, Professor Kasturi describes so many things that they see, especially the giraffes and the ostriches. And this is something, again, Prem, if you just have to search in the browser for Nairobi National Park and go to image search. The first few images that come are those of giraffes standing against a backdrop of multi-story buildings. You know, you'll wonder, what is this? Is a giraffe walking in the city? But that's a giraffe in the Nairobi National Park. Because the Nairobi National Park is possibly, comparatively, a smaller area. Very small area compared to the Serengeti or the Gorongoro crater. It's a very small area with a lot of animals inside, because of which you can actually take photos with the city landscape in the background and the animals in front. So they see a lot of animals, Professor Kasturi and the others, in this Nairobi National Park, before finally they are given the permission to land at the Embakasi Airport. As we had discussed earlier, it was then known as Embakasi Airport. Today it's called the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport, named after the founding father for Kenya, that is Mr. Jomo Kenyatta. So they land at the Embakasi Airport, and from there, Swami is driven straight to a ground, to a massive gathering of 20,000 people. 20,000 people have gathered in eagerness to listen to Swami speak. And that is where they drive, and Swami is going to address them. Professor Kasturi, he sees this sight, and again, everything we are telling from Professor Kasturi's perspective, because his is the only account we have got with us. So he says that this was something that Kenya had never witnessed before, because such a gathering of all kinds of people. There were Christians, there were Hindus, there were Africans, there were Indians, there were all religion, all caste, all creed, because this was a master who had come to share that love, and everybody was basking in the love, and that huge crowd that had gathered, it was such a sight that instead of heading to the dais, Swami took a detour and out of love spent half an hour, you know, almost walking through the people, granting them Pada Namaskar, a smile, a talk, a touch, different things, and I'm sure that he would have physically touched thousands of people. Of course, he had touched millions, and all of them could not come here. The 20,000 who were lucky enough to come here, all of them had been touched by Swami, but a few thousands got physically touched by Swami, because Swami moved around, blessing them, giving vibhuti to many, materializing different things, and he had a darshan session before actually ascending the dais from where he would be addressing. On that day, it was Dr. C.G. Patel who addressed the gathering first, and he introduced Swami, if at all he needed an introduction, after which it was Bhagwan's discourse.
And absolutely, I think 20,000 is a huge crowd, and they say that never before Kenya had witnessed a gathering such as that. And I mean, it really, you know, beats you how Swami's name had already spread so much. And I mean, in a city like Mumbai now, or you know, Chennai or Delhi, it's understandable if Swami's name is spread and if people are able to come to a place and gather in those days with minimum means. And talking of Nairobi, in fact, in one place, Professor Kasturi says that it's one of the few cities in the world where people wake up not to the sounds of, you know, a cock-a-doodle-doo, but the roars of lions. Because that's, you know, that's where the city is.
And that's the Nairobi National Park for you.
Right, that's the Nairobi National Park. And it, certainly, you know, the crowd gathering would have not been so easy, people coming and gathering in this place. To come to a place like that, they must have really known Swami to a certain extent, or rather... Felt for him to have come and gathered there. And Professor Kasturi writes that Swami begins his discourse by saying Divyatma Swarupulara. And I wonder what would have been the reception there. Because here was Swami standing on the dais and referring to everyone as embodiments of divinity. Maybe in one way the African crowd would have been able to relate to that much more than probably any of us who are brought up with modern education. Because I think a few years back there was a drama by children from South Africa. you know, where they spoke about the typical African culture and some of the understandings which come with the
Ubuntu, African. I think. Yeah, Ubuntu.
Right, Ubuntu is one. The other was about an African grandmother teaching the children about the African culture. Right? Because one
around
of the
big tree or something
right,
like that.
Exactly, right, exactly. The big tree, and there was a name for that tree, I completely forgot. You know, where she actually narrates this incident, I mean, this philosophy of just like how you look at nature, and it's very easy for us to connect to divinity looking at nature, right? There's a discourse where Swami started off like that. When you see the hills, when you see the sky, you automatically think of God. Because we are able to relate to nature as an reflection of divinity. And most of the African, you know, the traditional, the native African belief was from this belief that all of nature is divine. And they very effortlessly saw themselves as part of nature, which is probably what modern science stops us from seeing most of the time. You know, we distance ourselves from nature and look at nature. They saw themselves as part of nature, and I think when Swami said Divyatma Swarupalara, it would have been quite easy for them to relate to that, because they always traditionally believed that they were part of nature and nature was part of God, which was a fundamental message that Swami always spoke about, right?
Swami continued by saying that, you know, the same thing. He further dilated on this same theme. He said that the relationship between the Jivatma and the Paramatma, the individual self and the Supreme Self, is like that of the relationship between the wave and the ocean. Though we have two terms calling wave and one the ocean, they are just the same. It is just the same, but they manifest in two different ways. The wave is just the part of the ocean. And it's also like the relationship between the bulbs and the current. You know, the variety that we see, the diversity that we see is only in the shape, size, voltage and color of the bulb. But the current that is animating, that is lighting up each of the bulb is the same, that is the Paramatma. And then Swami said that if man does not make effort to realize this, he is only furthering his own life sentence. You know, Swami calls this human life as a life sentence, as an imprisonment, where we are locked in by our senses, our mind and different things. And if we don't escape from this, it is like a life sentence. You know, this entire discourse is actually given in the Satya Sai Speaks. Only thing is, this was delivered on the 3rd of July in the evening. In the Satya Sai Speaks, it has wrongly been labeled as 4th of July. So 4th July 1968, we can have a look at that discourse. Because Swami speaks of only the ultimate goal in human life. It's amazing, you know, because just think of it, you and me, we have to go to different places to give talks. How we will be trying to modify our talks to, you know, suit the people there or suit the culture there or whatever. You know, we make definitely changes in our content based on the audience. But Swami speaks the truth, because there is only the truth to be spoken, and that is what he said there. He said that in order to realize your true your life purpose, you need the gifts of Viveka and Vijnana, that is wisdom and knowledge. And you will get Viveka and Vijnana from the Vedas. Just look at the thing, you know, Swami is just saying all this. And another important thing that Swami said in the discourse was this ultimate atmic principle, it expresses itself as love. And the goals of life are four, that is the four purusharthas. But actually, if you look at them, they are not four purusharthas. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha, they are not four. But they are actually two pairs of purusharthas, Swami said. He said that dharma, artha are together, kama, moksha are together. And all the problems in the world today is because you are getting artha through adharma and you are having kama for the jagat instead of for moksha. So this was the way Bhagwan began his discourse.
I mean, when Swami speaks about the Vedas, yeah, as you're saying, that, you know, some of us might find that...
I don't think we'll ever speak about Veda there.
Right? We'll speak about Vedas. But you know, when Swami is speaking about the Vedas, in fact, the introductory statement which Swami makes is, Swami says, look beyond the skin, because beyond the skin you are one. And when Swami spoke that, Swami could really speak that with authority, because Swami was so very, you know, the Sanskrit word which they use is sahaja. So commonly he was, so freely he was
spontaneously
merging with all of them. And, you know, we've seen this. And I think when Swami walked through the crowd, that absolute neutrality between whether you're an Indian or you're an African, you're a worker or you're a, you know, ambassador or whatever it is. The way Swami related, I think Swami actually was living that Vedantic principle, as Swami told Professor Nanjunya through a letter once. He said there is only one best way to propagate Vedanta, and that is through practice. And literally Swami is doing that, because, you know, we've seen those pictures of the Africa trip. I think our listeners should go to the website and see it in the Africa. There's a cover story and a couple of articles on that.
So you just go to the website and search for the term Africa?
Yeah, probably East Africa. I'm sure some of those articles should show up. You can see that there is no difference in Swami's countenance whether he's standing next to in a group of Indians or he's standing in a group of Africans. There is so much love in the same. This one, I mean, I know we are probably speaking about it again and again, but that is really what would have drawn these people. I remember Anil Kumar says, speaking of an incident where some tribal people had once come to Parthi, and I forget the name. There's a tribal community which lives pretty close to this area, and a lot of them come and would come.
The Lombardis.
The Lombardis, right. That's the word. The Lombardis. Once a good number of them had come, I think 40, 50 of them, and typically dressed in their typical tribal outfit, and they were quite different and distinct from the rest of the crowd which had come for darshan. And Swami had called all of them for the interview, you know, 40 of them. And you know, Professor Anil Kumar, you know what is not to be told to Swami, but you tell it to Swami so that you get a beautiful response from him. Mm. And typically like that, after the interview, he said, Swami, how can you bear to be in the room with all these people? You know, how did you call these people? And he was saying that, you know, they probably exude a bad odor.
They don't use powders and deodorants.
Right, and they're quite different. And Swami pretended as though he was very upset. And Swami said, they're also mine. And Swami spent as much time as he would have spent with probably a group from Germany or America or, you know, students group with those people. And I'm sure Swami's, you know, the message would have been no different. Because if the message is applicable for a person who is in the highest strata of society, it's applicable even for the lowest. Because the message is the same. And that's precisely what we can see here. You know, he has gone into this African country. He's speaking to predominantly African audience. But the message is the same. Because the way he behaved was the same, whoever it was. And I think that's why you cannot differentiate or distinguish between Swami's life, Swami's actions, and Swami's message as he spoke it.
You know, if you remove those references to, those little references to Africa that Swami is making, in fact, even that is not there, you know, unless you go and check in the end where it is written, Nairobi, 1968, you will not even know where Swami is giving this discourse, you know. There also, you know, the focus for Swami has been the youth and the youngsters. In fact, Swami says that the body that has been given to us is a raft. And we have to make use of it to cross this ocean called samsara before it becomes unserviceable. Because the raft has a lifetime. And in that lifetime, you have to use it to actually cross. You have to cross. Don't wait till it becomes unserviceable and it won't help you to cross. So therefore Swami stresses that it's important that you learn at a young age itself. And that is why schools and homes become so important, because that is where the young are. That is where the rafts that are freshly manufactured are. So spend time daily, whether it's a school or home, in thinking of God. In conclusion, you know, Swami also, I think, gave a peep into what his mission is, because he tells, I'll just read out that discourse excerpt from the Satya Sai Speaks, where Swami is saying, I have come to light the lamp of love in your hearts, to see that it shines day by day with added luster. I have not come on behalf of any particular dharma, like the Hindu dharma. I have not come on any mission of publicity for any sect or creed or cause. Nor have I come to collect followers for any doctrine. I have no plan to attract disciples or devotees into my fold or any other fold. I have just come to tell you of this universal unitary faith, this atmic principle, this path of love, this prema dharma, the duty of love, this obligation to love. That's all. I have just come here to talk to you about your duty, your obligation, your pleasure, your privilege to love. That's all. That is the only message, because that's how Swami concludes, that's how Swami begins also, saying that I have come to light the lamp of love in your hearts. And absolutely he did that. He actually created a conflagration of love in the hearts of people, because that was a warmth and that searing passion that they felt towards this little diminutive orange-robed afro-haired figure from India.
And I think that discourse and what Swami said must have inspired Professor Kasturi to name that book on the East Africa trip as The Light of Love, right? Because literally, you know, it was a dark continent in many ways, as we're seeing the number of political struggles which come through. We spoke about it in the first satsang which we had, about how, you know, the continent had to go through a lot of struggle even at this point, and it, I think even today there's no end to the amount of struggle they go through. It really was a beautiful reprieve for them to see Swami and Swami going there. No wonder Swami chose East Africa more than anything else. And as we were talking about that discourse, Swami concludes the discourse as he always does with by singing Namavali bhajans, and the whole audience erupted and joined Swami as he led them in that bhajans. And after that discourse was completed, Swami retired to the house of the devotee who was hosting him in the city of Nairobi that evening, right?
And something interesting happens there and late in the evening, because as we had discussed earlier, this is the first time that many members in Swami's entourage are watching a television. That is when a television program was going on. And it was a thrilling new experience, as thrilling as seeing animals in the wild. And as they watched the television, let's remember this is 1968. Probably there was just one or two channels there. And it is not a mind-boggling maze of channels that it is today. Okay, so even in that time, Swami, you know, was strongly against television. He called it televisham. Televisham meaning telepoison. Poison that comes through this. He said that, you know, this television is blunting the higher impulses and at the same time activating lower impulses. Therefore, it is bad. And it is doing this because the objective with which the programmers are making program is not noble, is not lofty, is not for promoting the divine ideals in man. It is for catering to the lower impulses, the animal instincts of man. And that is why television programming is there. That is why it is poison. If on the other hand, Swami also made a statement that if on the other hand it is used for noble thoughts, for propagating such noble ideals, then it could be a medium of use. But it was almost like Swami didn't expect it to be like that, because everybody who is involved in the programming is doing it with selfishness and self-interest in order to cater to the things that lie under the senses, sensual things. That is the reason, you know, Swami spoke out strongly against the television, though his whole entourage watched the television probably for the first time in their lives, many of them.
1968, I was saying that there must mean hardly anything for Swami to give such a strong opinion about
exactly
the television, you know. It was not about the technology. You know, you have this kind of thing even in the villages in the past. They would not like photography. They would say that if you take photograph of a person, his age will reduce. You know, those are actually irrational thinking. But what Swami was saying was very, very precise, and what really was prophetic, because we've seen that happen. And to think of it, that even the idea that people are doing programs so that you spend more time watching it, it's actually was not the case in 1968. 1968, it must have been used as a means of pushing content, you know.
And Prem, I feel even if, you know, they had done it with the intention that, yeah, I'm creating a program, it's very costly to create, TV airtime, setting up this apparatus is so costly, so naturally I want as many people to see it. It wouldn't have appeared like anything bad. Yeah, of course, this is something unique and I want people to watch. What's wrong in that?
There was no business motive in that, because, you know, till I think 70s or even early 80s, most of these TV programming was controlled by the government.
Correct.
And it was purely used for dispensing information. You know,
disseminating information.
Right. Be it your programs for the farmers or programs regarding health and public issues.
Or notices.
Right. But, you know, now it's a completely different thing. They want you to see, because the more you see, the more their business's purposes are served. And for Swami to refer to that during the first time they were watching TV was, I think, very, very profound.
I was the other day when speaking to Dr. Raghunath Sharma, he was speaking of how when Swami had visited Pamidi, which is his native place, he had visited his grandfather's time, you know, this is somewhere in the 1940s. And Swami pointed to one region across the river there, I forgot the name of the river now, maybe Penna River, I think. Yeah, and Swami said, there will be a bridge over here. And people thought that Swami must have been joking, or why is Swami saying like this? Because, first of all, the town was not such a big town. Secondly, there's already a bridge that exists. Why should somebody build another bridge when one already exists? But he says almost 30-40 years after Swami had said that, somewhere in the 1980s, actually another bridge came. And he's saying when it came, they were also thrilled and wonderstruck. I was reminded of this because it is similar to that case here, you know. As you said, in 1968, a television did not seem like such a big deal. It did not seem like such a big deal in the sense that it is going to cause harm and going to become one of the major problems that society is going to face. It never looked like that. But even at that time, Swami spoke so strongly, and possibly many would have seen Swami as being simply too strong against it, you know. Like how we felt, you know, in our times in the late 1990s, when Swami criticized the internet, we were thinking, no, Swami, come on, internet is not, it's not such a bad thing, you know, it gives us information. We thought of it as a more innovative encyclopedia possibly. But today when you look at where it's headed to, the internet of things, people are talking about how this kind of interconnection in the virtual world has led to such a disconnect in the real world, is going to lead to a massive unemployment across, is going to lead to this unemployed youth will not know what to do, they'll be frustrated, they will take up terrorism, and suddenly you see how everything is connecting up and actually being the cause for all the massive, most damaging problems that we see today. You know, so when Swami possibly makes it, we may think that, hey, come on, how is this? And possibly Swami is just making a sweeping statement. But when the Lord makes a sweeping statement, He's making it because it is that. It is that. It is not a sweeping statement. It is the absolute truth. Unembellished truth. And what Swami said in 1968 about the television, today everybody is realizing that. Trying to make conscious efforts to step back on an addiction that possibly we have come too far into.
Right. And I think, you know, whenever Swami makes such statements, be it the television or the internet, probably we cannot completely avoid it, you know, especially if parents are listening to this program and they're wondering, you know, if this is what Swami has said about the internet or the TV, what do you do? I think pretty much there is nothing much we can do to completely avoid it. I don't think it's there in our ability to do that. Because even Swami, when he spoke about the television, there were students in the 80s when Swami would say that don't watch the TV at all. It was quite easy because there was only 6 hours of program. You just have to ensure that you do something else during that time. But a later time, probably when we were students, the late 90s and 2000s, Swami would say, don't go out for a movie. Because there you're putting so much more effort and you are, you know, making a decision to go and watch something. You can at least avoid that. You know, what is there coming your way is a different thing. But you making an effort to go and watch something is a different thing. So similarly, I think when Swami says this, it's like saying that you're going down a road and somebody comes and tells you, you know what, there's a pit there, just be careful. So I think the message is, these are the pitfalls in these technologies. Be careful of that.
Slow down, you know, a bit.
Slow down and be aware of it even as you're using it. And I think that is what is important.
So with that, you know, that is how the 3rd of July came to an end in Bhagwan's beautiful African sojourn. The listeners, will quickly take a break over here and come back and possibly introduce the next day, the 4th of July, before the end of this segment.
Yeah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are on the 3rd of July, 1968. That's where Swami completed his first wildlife safari in East Africa. And, of course, we also spoke about the first discourse which Swami gave to the gathering there in Nairobi. That was in the evening of 3rd July. On 4th July in the morning, Swami makes another trip.
This time Swami is taken to what we already spoke about, the Nairobi National Park that is so close to the city. As you said, they wake up, instead of to the roosters crows, they wake up to the lion roars. And Professor Kasturi was told that a lot of animals are frequently seen. And he had possibly his first pleasant surprise or a shock when as they were driving to the national park on the road in the middle, they see five cheetahs, you know, having a kind of a conference. And it's amazing. You know, we are used to seeing dogs on the street. Here, they see cheetahs. And Kasturi is very surprised, amazed. And he says that even as they came close, the cheetahs seemed to get disturbed in their conference or meeting, and they curse these intruders who are disturbing their morning chat, and they walk to a side and continue with their conversation, and they continue to drive on. So, of course, this is not the road in the city. This is on the road in the national park once they have entered. So that is the thing. And the same standard animals, the giraffe, the ostriches, the antelopes, the zebras, they see all the animals. What is unique over here is possibly the visit to the hippo pool.
Right, and we can already sense Swami becoming restless. Right, and right, they go to this hippo pool where, you know, they see hippopotamus and the crocodiles living together. And again, Swami does not miss the opportunity to point out that there is so much of harmony in nature. And that's a point which Swami would many times tell us, that, you know, even when there is killing happening, it's killing happening only for the need part of it, not for the desire, not for the aggression or expression of aggression. It's always only a need-based event which is happening, as you're saying. It's just, and even otherwise, I think many times in these programs we see that, you know, the animals of prey don't go and attack a herd, even if it is right in front of it, if it's not the time for its food.
Right? Correct. It's absolutely need-based, not greed-based. A lion never thinks that, you know, let me swat away two more zebras and keep them for storage. It's only man who thinks like that. Because of that, he has invented refrigeration, storage, pickling, different kind of things. But it's always because we always, it's greed-based. And it's never sufficient. Today, I think, why not swat away at two zebras, tomorrow why not store 10 zebras, why not store 100 zebras? There's no end to it, you know, there's no limit to it.
And so many other opportunities come in, right? You know, because when you store, it comes out of fear. And if the refrigeration business comes in and they say that they want to make you buy a better refrigerator, they'll create more fear in you, that you can store for longer in this, and the food does not get spoilt in this. And it really becomes like a business of fear after that. Right.
Everything is almost like a business of fear. And it's over there, you know, again, if you have a look on the video, all these videos I went and checked on YouTube. If you see that hippo pool, it's literally teeming with hippos. I mean, it's mind-boggling to see that many hippos. And I mean, just like what in India, in villages, what I'm used to seeing, 20, 30 buffaloes in a pond. That is the way hippos are there, because whatever hippos I have seen in India, the hippopotamuses, is possibly in the nearby Bannerghatta National Park or in the Mysore Zoo. It's like a prized display, and there are maybe three hippos in separate enclosures that too, each one can view, you can go and view each one of them. And here it's massive, a lot of them. And Swami points out, and he also emphasizes on the fact that it's only man that goes and kills his own kind. Whether for need or greed, none of the animals, they usually kill their own kind. They always kill others, you know, in defense or for food. It's only man that kills his own kind. And see, one can say that is how animals are programmed. Man is not programmed like that. You know, all said and done, animals are programmed like that. You will not see one buffalo killing another buffalo. They will never do that. And so you can say that it's not man's fault because man is not programmed that way. That is where Swami says that discrimination has been given to man. You can use that discrimination to choose to go above the level of animals. That is what discrimination does, you know. You can, if used properly, you can discriminate and choose to go above the level of animals. But if you want, you can choose to go against the basic rules that God has built even for animals. And go against it and go below the level of animals also. So that power of choice has been given, I think, with a reason, and that is the reason why human beings are considered as the crown jewel, crest jewel of God's creation. We have to make use of the discrimination to rise above the level of animal and not misuse it in order to go stoop to levels even lower than that of animals.
Right. And as Swami is driving into the national park, as we're seeing that they visit the hippo pool, but after lunch they drive to this place called the Nanyuki, which is actually right bang on the equator, and it's what, 6400 feet above sea level, and that's the place where they plan to embark on for that particular night, because that's a very, very special trip which they are taking Swami for. I don't think generally people who go there, you know, as tourists would probably make this trip, you know, flying across the Serengeti or driving into the national park is a common thing, but this is a very special activity they're taking Swami for, because this is like you spend one full night right in the national park, and that is what is Swami's, you know, the next item on Swami's agenda on that day.
That you can make out, see, the host is keen to show all the different kind of wildlife reserves. So just yesterday you've seen Serengeti, you've seen Lake Victoria, you've seen the crocodiles. Forgot to mention that you've seen the crocodiles in Lake Victoria. Then you've seen Lake Natron, you've seen flamingos. You've seen Gorongoro crater. Now today morning you're seeing the
National Park
in Nairobi, and now you're setting off to Nanyuki. Interestingly, Nanyuki is located at 0 degree 1 minute north of the equator. Means it's almost bang on the equator, and in fact Professor Kasturi writes that there is a little hotel which proudly proclaims that the equator passes through our hotel, you know. So you can go to the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere by simply hopping across a tile in our hotel. That is the way they proudly proclaim for themselves. Nanyuki also happens to be the base camp for all those wishing to trek one of the tallest mountain peaks in that country, that is Mount Kenya. Possibly it is the tallest in Kenya and one of the tallest in African continent. So those who wish to trek to Mount Kenya, they use Nanyuki as the base camp. And this is where they have brought Swami, as you said, and they go to stay in a game lodge called the Secret Valley Lodge. And what happens there is very interesting. And what is more interesting and insightful is the message that Swami gives there. We have got a lot to learn from that. But I think that will require us to go in certain depth into Swami's philosophy. And that we don't have time now, dear listeners, because the time in our studios is 1:58. And we will stop here and we will continue from here, that is at Nanyuki, in our next week's satsang of the African Odyssey. So do join us. We are still in the 4th of July. We have got more than 10 days to go in the African Odyssey. I'm sure we will enjoy it. We hope you have been enjoying it as much as both Prem and me are enjoying it. We offer this segment at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. We are grateful to him for doing the African trip and for giving us the opportunity to travel in this virtual manner 50 years after the actual African trip. We end this with a bhajan, on the other side of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
Kamala Vadana Sai Ranga, Kamala Vadana Sai Ranga, Kamala Vadana Sai Ranga. Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai.